got to be very mindful of how sharp your elbows might be. And it's much more about consensus building than probably any other role that I've been in. And so that's certainly been an adjustment to my leadership style.
Welcome to another edition of the Columbia University Sports Podcast, The Cusp Show, where we talk about the business of sports, media, entertainment, athletics, all different kinds of stuff. I'm Joe Favorito. My co-host Tom Richardson today is off doing other things, so I'm joined by our able-bodied producer, Mike Schroeder, sitting in again today. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to have this conversation today with our guests, so thanks again.
Yeah, and I don't know if you cross paths with our guest today at our conference, but he sat in on our Olympics panel, which was great and really added a lot of insight, I think, especially into people in the room who didn't understand how NGBs work. And we've had some other people on talking about it, but the sport of lacrosse is obviously continuing to grow, but also will have the largest stage that it has ever had returning to that large stage, which is the Olympics in LA 28. So Mark Riccio, a longtime friend and colleague who is now the CEO of USA Lacrosse, is joining us today. And Mark, welcome to the Cusp Show.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks, Mike. Very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Cool. So Mark, you've had quite a career in various places, including a pretty prominent run with a New York local team in the NFL and some other places. Why don't you kind of walk us through how you got to where you are, and then we could kind of dig into the lacrosse world.
Sure. So grew up in Western New York in small town USA, a place called Canandaigua, New York, in the Finger Lakes. And I did play lacrosse in high school and in college. And that's what brought me down to the New York region. I went to Hofstra. I went to school there, played there. And that's also where I started my career. I started right out of school, went to grad school there as well, and started working in the alumni relations and development office and worked in fundraising around athletics. And it was at that time that I had met people that work at the New York Jets, because that's where the New York Jets used to have their offices and training facilities. Mm-hmm. And I met some people, and that led to a job of opportunity, which I was fortunate enough to get at the Jets, and a 17-year run at the New York Jets. And that included stints of working in Long Island, New York City, and New Jersey. Went through all of those transitions to new stadiums and new training facilities. My run at the Jets ended in 2013 and went in to do some consulting on my own, went with a startup, became a bit of an accidental entrepreneur, actually, which was a great learning, which really informs a lot of how I approach things today. But ultimately landed with a small event company that I had worked with at the Jets, and we were acquired and negotiated a sale of that, went to a global agency and spent 4 years there, and then onto a small IP and law firm consultancy. And this job opened up, and I kind of threw my hat in the ring because it was a combination of all of my previous experiences. Survive in advance. And here I am about 3.5 years later.
Wow. Before we move on to lacrosse, talk about kind of how you started at the Jets and Hofstra and how that kind of evolved over time to where you actually ended up, you know, leading the business side. So, and what was that like, and how did you grow from time to time?
So what was interesting is when I went in at the Jets, like many of these jobs, particularly at that time, probably even more so at that time, the job wasn't advertised. You didn't find it through a recruiter, through any other, you know, want ads, quote unquote. It was a relationship. They were looking to expand their business. And I happened to have a relationship with some folks who put me in front of the individual whose name is Bobby Parente, who oversaw the business side, who ultimately hired me at the Jets. But what was interesting is I went in under the previous ownership, Leon Hess and the Hess family. And so it was a mom and pop operation when I went into the Jets. Smaller, we were a low quartile, bottom quartile revenue team because we didn't generate the revenue at the stadium. We were a tenant. And so also we were 1-15 my very first year. And that was an incredible lesson because you turn on the radio and everybody's saying everybody should be fired, from the janitor right up to the GM. And I was thinking, I just got here. What do I have to do with wins and losses? But the reality is you realize you do impact wins and losses at all aspects of an organization. But also I learned to not get too high, not get too low. You've got to control what you can control and not be overreactionary to the emotion of sport. You know, my mom once told me a great quote, you know, sports is life with a volume turned up. The highs are higher and the lows are lower. And you have to be able to ride through that. So those were great lessons. But what happened is ownership transition happens at the New York Jets. And through that time, I was able to change from spending part of my day doing marketing, part of my day running events, part of my day selling, to predominantly moving towards sales, sponsorship, revenue generation. And that was another great learning, is that if you focus, you can actually do more. And that my move into revenue generation as an area of focus was really changing my career in terms of impact on a business, seeing the entire organization, because a lot of the organization runs through revenue generation. And so that was another great learning, building a stadium or attempting to build a stadium on the west side of Manhattan, and actually it not happening was a great learning. Eventually building a stadium, becoming a joint venture partner with your competitor in the market, meaning the Giants, also learned. And a training facility. We built a new training facility. All of those experiences have informed how I approach the job today. Everything from how we manage our headquarters and training facility, how we deal with athletes, coaches, partners that are also competitors. And so the other and last key takeaway from all of that is every 2 to 3 years, you need to reinvent yourself a little bit. It's not because you need to make a wholesale change into who you are and what you do, but every 2 to 3 years, whether it's a new responsibility, a new skill set, maybe it's a promotion and a title change, maybe it's actually going to a new organization, but reinventing yourself, learning new skills every 2 to 3 years, I think is really important. And I was able to do that in part by accident. And then after I figured it out, it was in part on purpose. And I think that helped me continue to advance and grow in my career.
Yeah, Mike has heard me say this numerous times. I think one of the people in the world who has reinvented himself time and time again is Snoop Dogg. And his whole thing, he talks about being relevant and understanding what's going on. Somebody comes along and they want me to use, some kind of contraption. Okay, I'll do that. Solo Stove. I saw the Solo Stove commercial today with Snoop Dogg, And he talked about, but he's sold everything over the years and continues to keep himself relevant and interesting. And one of his biggest outlets this year was the Olympics and what he did with NBC, which is a good kind of transition into USA Lacrosse, how you ended up at an NGB, what an NGB does, and probably give us, for people who don't know, because a lot of our listeners are from outside of the United States. Why lacrosse in the Olympics, and how does that all fit together?
By the way, great comparison to Snoop Dogg. I anxiously and joyously followed him through the Olympics. He was great.
It
And
was
so I think
amazing.
he definitely is a definition of reinventing yourself periodically. So an NGB, National Governing Body, in the United States, amateur and Olympic sport falls under these governing bodies. And they're consistent with other governing bodies in other nations. The big difference in the US compared to other nations is we do not get government funding. So we are empowered, if you will, through the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee, who is in turn empowered by the 10 Stevens Act of Congress. So that gives us our legal standing, but it doesn't fund us. So everything that we do, we must go out and raise money on our own. And I'll get to that in a minute, because that is, relates to your question about like, how was that? How did I end up there? And so our mandate is fuel the growth, enrich the experience, field the best national teams. So that's our mission. Again, I'll come back to that. But what's also really important, we are a 501c3. And that's just a legal way of saying that we're a quasi-public company and that we can't hold profit. Any profit or excess that we have, we must reinvest back into the mission. That fuel the growth, enrich the experience, field the best national team mission. And so we operate, frankly, much like a team. And this was something when I tell people that, they're very surprised. But if you think of the fundamentals of team sport, particularly in the US, let's say, but any team sport, and I've had the pleasure to work globally with Premier League and other global sports, you have sponsors, and just like we do, you have season ticket holders, or what's like our members. You have boards and investors that you have to work with. You have coaches, you have athletes, you have training facilities, you have international competition calendars that you need to manage with the pro calendars. You have revenue generation, you have fundraising, so fan development, commercial media, and then of course you have your entire infrastructure of facilities, operations, travel. It's the same as actually working at a team. From our governing process, what we do is we are the infrastructure primarily at the youth level. So everything from rules, equipment approvals and certifications, health, safety, background checks. At the end of the day, our number one job is protect the athlete. And so we, as a 501c3, meaning we're not motivated by profit, can do that with credibility and with trust. We also work with our governing body partners, which are actually the NFHS, which is the National Federation of High Schools, which oversees the state high school associations, and the NCAA, which in the states oversees colleges and universities. So we are one of the three governing bodies in the sport of lacrosse. And so we say we work at the base of the pyramid, meaning getting more kids into lacrosse, giving them that experience opportunity, and doing everything to hope they stay with the game and have a lifelong relationship with it. And then, of course, we work at the tip of the pyramid, which is putting teams into international competition. We have 12 national team programs, so we're just like USA Basketball and USA Hockey, USA Soccer. That's our job. And so that's the role we play in the ecosystem, and we have to work with everybody to achieve that.
And we'll get to Mike, who, by the way, is from Ridgewood, New Jersey, the arguably one of the largest lacrosse hotbeds, not just in New Jersey, but in the world. I want you to touch on one other thing, which is world lacrosse. So people would say, what's world lacrosse? I mean, lacrosse is pretty much, a North American sport, founded by indigenous peoples and, on and on, and played in colleges and high schools, yes, but is there really a world business? And how does world lacrosse factor into that? And tell us about how it got into the Olympics, actually.
So the World Lacrosse is our international federation. And you are right. What's most people, and this is also a North American bias. In the US, we tend to focus on stick and ball US sports. It's only recently that people have started to realize that there's a great big beautiful world out there of sport, from cricket to global football, aka soccer, or track and field. There are certainly other sports that live beyond, the United States. So that was one of my great learnings in working at a global agency, is recognizing what is out there in terms of a global sport. So World Lacrosse is the international federation, comparable to FIFA or say FIBA and soccer and basketball. There are 90 nations, over 90, I think we're at 93 now, that actually are recognized by World Lacrosse that play lacrosse. Now there's varying degrees of size, meaning number of players, number of national teams. World Lacrosse is also recognized by the IOC, the International Olympic Committee. So we've done everything in terms of proper governance and process to achieve that status. And I'll use a couple examples. So certainly US, Canada, the Haudenosaunee, which is the Native American teams in the US and Canada, some of the top teams for sure. But Puerto Rico, Great Britain, and Japan. Japan is actually the next great lacrosse nation. They play excellent lacrosse. Australia, Hong Kong, China. I mean, there's really a level of international growth that has happened. And the credit really goes to World Lacrosse for achieving that. They rec We hired at World Lacrosse and the CEO, a gentleman by the name of Jim Shear. Jim is the former head of the USOPC. He knew exactly what it would take to get into the Olympics. And he set lacrosse on that path several years ago, and he's done a great job. And to answer that question, like, how did we get into the Olympics? So LA 28, just like Paris and Japan before that, the local organizing committee that runs the Olympics. So in our case, LA 28 is a new entity that the USOPC empowered to run the Olympics, commercialize it, and so forth. LA 28 has the right, but not the obligation, to add local sports to the program. They're not exhibition sports. They are full metal sports. And there's a lot of horse trading and negotiation that goes on in that process. But lacrosse was at it, as well as flag football, cricket, squash, baseball, softball. And I think I'm missing one. But with that, before I go into that last sport, the calculus that LA 28 will look at is in part, is it gender equitable? Are you getting your best athletes to compete in that sport? Is it global enough? Commercially, how will it help us sell more tickets? How will it help us drive more viewership and streaming for NBC? And also, what is the legacy and impact it can have on that local community, in this case, LA? And also, what is the carbon footprint? How complex and costly is it actually to execute this sport at the Olympics? So we'll look at all those things. And you referenced this earlier. The US has a great lacrosse tradition, particularly at the collegiate level. You get those national teams out there, you get the collegiate rivalries that drive that. Lacrosse fans tend to travel pretty well. And the thinking was, hey, this sport, particularly with its Native American roots, it's a great origin story, can really check the box on all of those measurables that LA 28 was looking at.
Cool. And lacrosse, for people who don't know, lacrosse was in the Olympics at one point.
Yeah, great point. So lacrosse was in the Olympics in 1904, I think 1928, 1932. It was just men's at the time. So this would be the first time women are in the Olympics, but it has been an Olympic sport in the past. And there's some great, we pulled up some archive articles of some great stories of great attendance at the LA Coliseum. The men's lacrosse team at the time had a day off. They went to try to go to Mexico to the world's largest bar, got stuck at the border, had to sleep overnight out in the desert. I mean, like, there's some great stories of, what went on in LA at the last Olympics. So it's really pretty fun and interesting to see 100 years later that we get another crack at it.
Cool. Mike?
So with lacrosse, there's been some rule changes in terms of like the face-off rule and those type of things to get commercial value. It's something I know you talked about at the conference. How do you think that's helped maybe make it easier or harder to develop and invest in youth lacrosse with those new rules? And how do you see that potentially helping the game going forward with just those rule changes?
Yeah, great question. So the lacrosse version of the game is called sixes. And it's the strategy that rugby undertook to go to rugby sevens, which is the same game, just less people on the field. Lacrosse took a similar strategy, and that had to do with the number of athletes per team and made it more palatable to get into the Olympics, commercially friendly, less of a lift, less cost, et cetera. So sixes is the format. And sixes is just what it says. Six on six, after a goal, the ball goes up and goes in the other direction. There's no face-offs or draws. There's also some subtle rule changes that make the game go faster. The field is also smaller. There's a shot clock, and there's no specialty. You just go. You run up and down. It's very similar to watching a basketball game. You just got lacrosse sticks and a lacrosse ball. And it's intuitive. Men, women, the men are still in equipment, women are not, because there are different versions of the game. And if a casual fan turns on and watches the game, they're going to get it right away. And what that's done is, one, it's also designed to make the game more competitive. You need less competitive athletes. The roster size is 12 versus 22 at the field level. So teams that might not be as deep in talent or nations that might not be as deep can still compete because you just need less athletes to field a really competitive team. And the game is much faster and tighter. So that obviously helps with the commercial value of it all, fits in a broadcast window better. So all of that has been unique and exciting. It creates a little disruption, but the way we've positioned it to our fans and lacrosse community and newcomers is it's no different. If you have alpine skiing, you got multiple disciplines of alpine skiing, downhill, giant slalom, moguls. In lacrosse, you have field. You have box lacrosse, which is an indoor version, and you have sixes. It's just a different discipline. But what it's done from a youth development standpoint is actually it's opened up an opportunity. Best practice for young kids, boys or girls, starting to play any sport, particularly a team sport like lacrosse, where there's skill involved, is playing on a smaller field. Just we call it small-sided play. It's called the athlete development model, and there's data and research and science, and USA Hockey really has pioneered this, where you get kids in a smaller environment where they can touch the ball more often. They can run around, they have a great experience. Sixes is the adult version of that. So as we introduce lacrosse at a young age, say 6, 7 years old, calling it sixes, playing on a smaller side field is best practice. But also for some of the more traditional lacrosse people, it legitimizes that strategy. And so it's absolutely helped in terms of new player acquisition and experience for a kid at a young age. How that changes and affects high school and colleges to be determined, because there are some high schools and colleges in less populated markets that are fielding sixes teams and leagues. And that's great because that just means more kids are playing the game. It's a stick and a ball in a field. But what the long tail effect is to be determined, but I don't think it'll have a material effect on the field game. It's just a really good point of entry to the game.
Cool. Speaking of points of entry, can you talk about the growth amongst girls and women? Now, there are two professional leagues for men, the PLL and the NLL, which is box. Athletes Unlimited has launched a platform for on the professional side for girls who can go on and play professionally, and obviously there's a need to keep them in the game going into LA 28. So what has the landscape looked like for getting more young girls and then eventually higher level athletes involved in lacrosse versus just guys?
Sure. So we see great growth in girls playing. I mean, this is consistent with what is happening in the US across the board in terms of girls playing sport. We're such an advocate for youth sport. Of course, it's lacrosse, but play a sport, if you can, because all the benefits, community benefits, individual health and wellness benefits, family benefits, leadership, adversity, discipline, all the things that we all know to be a benefit are there. And we see tremendous growth in youth participation with girls. And what's interesting coming out of COVID, one of the learnings is girls are starting to play lacrosse earlier than they used to. So that's an interesting insight that has been a post-COVID newness. What is also new is the entrance of flag football. And where does girls lacrosse fit into flag football? Flag football is offered as a fall sport in some places. It's offered as a spring sport in other places. We predominantly play in the spring. How does that impact summer participation? So there's a lot of similarities to be a multi-sport athlete in a sport like flag football and lacrosse and soccer and basketball. So how do we navigate that for the athlete? And how do we use that to our collective advantage for all of us who want girls to play? So that is something we're figuring out in real time, but we're very pleased with the continued growth of girls lacrosse. You also see continued growth at the collegiate level. They're adding more girls programs than men's programs. It's a gender equity issue. Certainly puts the men's programs, as it does with other men's sports, at a challenging moment in time at the collegiate level. But we're actually adding both men and women's programs just for women, or women's programs are coming online faster. And as you noted, at the pro level, Athletes Unlimited has a pro lacrosse league. I think it's 4 weeks, give or take. They actually play at our facility over the last 2 years at USA Lacrosse headquarters. So we have a good relationship with them. You also see the PLL has a women's exhibition product that they launched in the winter. They launched it last year. That it was a weekend tournament of sixes for some of the best women lacrosse players. We'll see how that develops. There's only more and more opportunity, but just like women's hockey, say over the last couple of years that had different leagues and then consolidated, they found their footing. Same thing you're seeing that with softball. You're going to see it with lacrosse, is that people are building these planes as they fly them. We're as supportive of pro athletes playing at every opportunity they get. Comes down to commercial models, right? Who
Yep.
can make it sustainable?
For sure. Mike?
So I want to talk a little bit about kind of your just like maybe your growth of your leadership in your time at USA Lacrosse. You obviously worked for the Jets, you ran your own kind of consulting practice. What did you take from those that helped you when you first walked into US Lacrosse? And then how do you think your leadership has evolved over time in the 3.5 years you've been there?
Oh, wow. The first thing, this is really self-indicting. My elbows are not as sharp as they used to be on purpose. And what I mean by that is, you work in New York, you work in the NFL, you get sharp elbows because you have to. And meaning that you got a little more of an edge to you. You got a little more of a sometimes New Yorker in you. And that is a bit by you get caught up into the intensity of the NFL in New York. And it's a bit you kind of have to. And I did learn, that concept, if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. And I'm going to sound like a total New Yorker because I think that's true. The more I've traveled globally and worked globally and been out of New York, I actually really believe that. So that's really one of the things I've learned is that you come into Baltimore, you come into 501c3, while and then nationally within our sport, which is comparatively speaking small, right? It's certainly more niche and developing than you would say the NFL. You've got to be very mindful of how sharp your elbows might be. And it's much more about consensus building than probably any other role that I've been in. And so that's certainly been an adjustment to my leadership style. Not that I didn't build consensus before, but you were a bit more hard charging in those other environments. This is far more about consensus building than before. So that's certainly the first thing. The second thing is the principles of commercial best practices, they do remain the same. And that getting people to think really not incremental growth, but exponential growth. Getting people to really take risk, responsible risk, is been some of the biggest challenges. Because it just hasn't been part of sometimes a 501c3 type of ethos. Now the organization has embraced that. They've also embraced data testing and learning in ways that we hadn't in the past. And I think that's also been a big change for folks. And then the last one has really been this revenue versus mission dynamic, is that we are a mission-based organization. As I said earlier, we generate revenue to fund the mission. But as my treasurer said when I walked into the role, the board treasurer, 501c3 is a tax status. It's not a business model. And that's really been my approach, is that we have to generate revenue. We have to be commercially responsible. It doesn't mean that we have to be profit motivated. We just need to be commercially responsible. And so getting people to embrace that has been part of the leadership challenges. But again, I think people have accepted it. We've raised more money than we've ever had in our history this year. We've also spent more than we've ever had in our history, right? There's also part of that. It's not just a revenue challenge, a high expense challenge. The last thing I'll say is I tell everybody every day, and this is from my startup learnings. You have a dollar, how am I going to spend it? I got an hour. How am I going to spend it? You have to be super disciplined with those two, because that we like any organization, but us more than ever, it's about resource allocation. And so what is going to give us the greatest impact for that dollar and for that hour, and be really thoughtful and disciplined on making those decisions.
Great.
Easier said than done, but that's really been the focus.
It's funny when people say they work for not-for-profit, people think, oh, we just take the money and just throw it out or spend it. And sadly, there have been international governing bodies with issues of way overspending, like we saw with the Cricket World Cup this summer, and heads rolled because it's not about just taking the money and, oh, let's go have a party at the end of the year. It's figuring out how you invest it back and make the most sense. And people don't, a lot of people don't realize the NFL is a not-for-profit. So you got to kind of figure out how to turn all those things around. The USO, obviously all the NGBs, the USTA with everything they generate at the US Open is a not-for-profit. So interesting mix. Question, if you could enlighten everyone on, even though it has not been determined yet, is the indigenous play that could potentially happen in LA. And talk a little bit about the indigenous roots of the sport that people may not know. With lacrosse being the creator's game, and some people may not know it's the official summer sport of Canada, box lacrosse. But what is that opportunity that is really intriguing that sits out there, if you could explain it as if the indigenous peoples are allowed to play as a sovereign nation? And why is it important, by the way, to the sport?
Well, you raise a couple of issues there. So I'll back up to your first point there on the roots of the game. So the origin story of lacrosse is, as you said, it was It's a creator's game. It was gifted to Native peoples by the creator. And then Native Americans, particularly the version that we play, is based comes out of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, which is upstate in New York, Canada, and Ohio. And that's the version of the game that we play. It was gifted to the rest of the world. There are other stick and ball like sports. Are there stick and let me back up. It's not a sport, it's a game. That's the first thing. You will not hear
Interesting.
Native Americans talk about lacrosse as a sport. It's a game. And so I want to be very mindful of that. And so you hear other nations, Choctaw Nation, down south or out west, where they have other stick and ball versions. And we support that in a lot of stuff that we do and try to in terms of cultural competency and education on the spiritual roots. And so the game is called the medicine game because it makes like medicine, it makes you feel better when you play. And the game was used to train warriors, but it was also trained to honor the creator. It was a game played to send away spirits. There were spiritual components to it. There was fun and competitive components to it. But the medicine game, because it makes you feel better with a clear mind, clear body, clear spirit, it's just got tremendous value. And I will tell you, this is not by accident. I've traveled the world. As I said, I've worked from African football to Australian Olympic committees to Premier League, Bundesliga, etc. I never hear more than lacrosse that this game changed my life than that sport. Meaning, like, I don't
Wow.
hear people say soccer changed my life or basketball changed my life. I hear people all the time say that game, lacrosse, changed my life. And that is really interesting because I do think it has to do in part with that Native American history and those roots. But you bring up a good point, and that is, will the Haudenosaunee be included in the LA 28 Olympics? The LA 28, well, first of all, that's a world lacrosse, LA 28, IOC, USOPC decision. USA Lacrosse, Canada Lacrosse, as examples, we've openly said we support it. But we can't make that decision. It's not our decision to make.
Got
And
it.
so what World Lacrosse is doing is working with LA 28, the IOC, on the eligibility criteria. How many teams are actually going to get into the LA 28 Olympics? Is it six? Is it eight? And what is the, what is the seeding process? We're already in as the host nation. And so those discussions are going on. What does that look like? The Haudenosaunee are not recognized by the United Nations. That's just a geopolitical fact. We make no statements on sovereignty and geopolitical issues. That is just fact, and that's how the IOC operates. With that said, is there a pathway into the Olympics? Again, LA 28 has supported it. We are certainly supportive of it, as is Lacrosse Canada. But that decision will be made, I believe, sometime towards the end of next year. But certainly we support and, hope for the best for them.
And the last thing on that note is that there is precedent because didn't Ireland give up their spot in the World Championships to let them play as a sovereign nation 2 years ago, I think it was?
Yeah, so this comes down to sovereignty and passport recognition. And so that's not an issue playing in the States, but it is an issue because some nations might not recognize the Haudenosaunee passport. And that's another geopolitical issue that
Wow.
we wouldn't weigh in on. With that said, for the U20 Men's Championship, which was held in Limerick, Ireland last summer, it had to do with seedings, rankings. And I don't know exactly why the Haudenosaunee were not admitted. It might have had to do with just the seeding and the number of teams. And ultimately, no, it was the World Games. I'm
Right.
sorry, excuse me, not the Men's U20. It was the World Games, which were held in Birmingham, Alabama, 2 summers ago, where that was the first demonstration of sixes in a world competition environment. And yes, the Ireland team gave up their spot for the Haudenosaunee to participate. And again, there's a lot of geopolitics that went on with that. But that was certainly recognized as a wonderful sportsmanship moment for Ireland to do that and honor the game's origins.
Cool. Mike, you got one more before we get to our last three? So lacrosse is obviously a growing sport, right? You guys want to continue to obviously grow outside the 2028 Olympics. What are the ways you think the future lacrosse can grow and be successful post 2028 Olympics as opposed to just caring about the Olympics?
No, great. So we launched a long-range plan last year, and we'll start to go much more public with this, like you do a capital campaign, right? You have a moment where you're doing all the behind the scenes work before you go big and public, but it's public. And we want to double participation by the end of the decade, and we want to utilize the Olympics certainly to accelerate that growth. So we, like many team sports, still are adversely affected by COVID. And that is a hangover that we still have. So I want to, that's important because it's informed our current strategy. And our current strategy is very much focused on 6, 7, 8-year-old kids, give or take, and introducing the game in a, boys and girls playing together, no equipment, small-sided, one stick, softball, gym floor, parking lot, a field, a backyard, in that sixes type pick up and play model. Because what we've learned, we've done some A/B testing, we've done focus groups, that is the lifetime value proposition, meaning that if a kid starts the game at 7, they're most likely to stay with the game the longest. Fun and friends matter. Kids play sports because of fun and friends. Let's all remember that. That is why they play. That's also why, for the most of them, stay playing. And so how do we facilitate that? And then how do we scale that? We've also learned that if a kid starts at the age of 7, that 7-year-old age group turns into 2.1 10-year-olds 3 years later. And
That's
we've
cool.
got multiple years of historical data. So we've got leading indicators. We've got all the formulas. Now it's about investing and then scaling. And so we're seeing that. We have more 6, 7, 8-year-old kids playing lacrosse today than we've ever had in our history. So we need to keep making extraordinary investments in that. And we have to go with partners to do that. We can't do that all by ourselves. So we formed a coalition called Elevate 28, and that is the PLL and the NLL, which are the two pro leagues you referenced, Athletes Unlimited as well, World Lacrosse, Josei Sports is a, Josei is a big benefactor of the game. He's been incredibly supportive of the game globally, for that matter. And then the Men's and Women's College Coaches Association, who have a big influence in the game. They're all part of this consortium where we are focused on new player acquisition, elementary age introductions to the game. That's the focus. Now, with that, you got to have coaching. So we have more certified coaches than we've ever had in our history. We've reversed the trends. We have actually more officials year over year than we did previously. So we because you need officials. So we're hitting the pinch points, but it's really, and then testing data, making sure that we're on track. We have market profiles so we can measure how our impact is having in each of, markets that we decide to focus on. But it is investment, right? And so now we're figuring out how do we go out, raise money at scale to invest in those growth strategies now that we've got some of the data and the formulas in place to scale.
It's interesting that you mentioned the officials because that is obviously a massive problem in this country. And great to hear that lacrosse is actually going the opposite way and getting people versus football and basketball and baseball, where people are running away and never want to walk on a field being an umpire or referee at this point.
Listen. You raise a good point. One of our challenges in youth sports in America is parents behaving badly. I mean, it really is unfortunate. You got an official out there, and these are things I've learned. Did you know most officials that they've got a system where they don't have water bottles, they don't have keys, they don't have anything, and they park next to the exit. So when the game's over, they don't have to go to a sideline, pick up anything. They can go right to their car and leave. How terrible is that? That that's what they
Terrible,
have to think
absolutely
through.
terrible. Yeah, terrible. So,
And just that concept that, that, and again, this is a youth sports in America challenge. And so we've worked with some organizations around sportsmanship and behaving better. We've actually worked with the Men's and Women's College Coaches Association on training outgoing college athletes at all levels, club, Division I, II, or III, and junior officials training. So and giving them the tools and resources to be effective officials. But also you got to go to the root problem and you got to root out. Here's the other thing I learned. Culture is what you tolerate and what you celebrate. And if you tolerate parents behaving badly, that's the culture of your sport. So, like, you got to get after it. That has its challenges, but that's also certainly something we're focused on.
cool. Well, before we let you go, we usually ask three questions. The middle one, career advice, you've given a lot of it, so we don't have to go back to that one, including the sharp elbows comment, which I thought was great. But the other two questions are important. You have so many things that you're looking at, whether it's the Olympic challenges, the youth sport challenges, the game challenges, the business challenges. What do you listen to? Who do you read? What do you kind of hear to stay up to date? That's number one. And then the last question is all the places you've been, and unfortunately, you don't have a Super Bowl ring, which could have been interesting. And people have raised the people have shown, like, oh, here's my bling with my ring. That's happened a couple of times. But what do you have? Like, what's on your mantle? What are the figurative or the tangible things that when you look back, you say, man, I can't believe I was involved in that. So how do you stay up to date? And then kind of what's those little tchotchke things that you have that you've saved?
What was it? I was so caught up on what's on my mantle. I actually, what was the first
The
question
first one
again?
is, how
That's
do you stay up to date? Like, what do you
okay.
listen
Stay up
to
to
when
date.
you read?
It's interesting. I don't watch a lot of sports, although the Jets were on last night. I caught a little of the game.
Hopefully the second half, not the first, but that's a different story.
No, I oh, this old guy had to go to bed.
Yeah.
I missed some great catches apparently. So, I do read a podcast. I do a lot of podcasts actually. One of my favorites is actually the Freakonomics. Yeah, Stephen Dubner and the Freakonomics, No Stupid Questions. What I really like about the Freakonomics series and some of the offshoot people I mostly admire, some of those podcasts, is that it gives a, I believe, a balanced look at both the economic but then behavioral outcomes. So I do think that's really valued because we make decisions based off of data and process, et cetera, but we also make more of our decisions off of emotion and behavior and both rational and irrational. And I have found that to be highly valuable. I listen to some of the sports podcasts, SBJ Daily and, Front Office. I read them every day, not every, start to finish, but certainly the big stuff and do share it. But it's more stuff outside of sport that I listen to that kind of keeps me thinking outside of domain. Best book I read recently is Range, really understanding that subject matter experience outside of the domain can be really helpful to applying solutions within a domain. And I've really taken that to heart in terms of how I try to build a leadership team and look at problem solving. In terms of what's on my mantle, I don't have much. I don't have an autographed. I have nothing autographed. I have one Jets hoodie. That's it. And what I really keep on my mantle, although I will say my first gold medal. So my time here, well, one, I spent 17 years at the Jets and had nothing from a championship to show for it. It was a great experience, but we just didn't get there. In my time here, I think I've gotten six gold medals already, and one and two silvers, three silvers. Like the competition at the highest level is really super cool to win, and so I was very fortunate to be a part of that. But the thing I keep honestly is I keep some stuff from home, meaning where I grew up in Canandaigua, and the reason why is. That's where it all started. Like you got to remember where you come from, that humility. And I keep that in my office. There's a plaque that a board member gave me who was from the area, Canandaigua, my hometown. I got a picture of the lake that I grew up on. And I think that sense of constant and home kind of keeps you grounded. Don't take yourself too seriously. Don't get too big or too low. Like all those friends that I grew up with, they know me as that guy who ran around playing lacrosse and football, not anything else. And so to me, that's really it. I don't have any other tchotchkes from sport, and I watch very little sport, which is the other surprising thing. It helps keep me balanced so I don't get too caught up in it all.
So I'll give you two non-sports ties to what you just talked about. The book you mentioned, you were the second person this week that mentioned the book. The other person
Ah.
who did it was Mark Milley, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who I saw speak with Ted Leonsis in Washington. He said that is a book that he has just read and is interested in. The other one I will give you last Saturday night, and this is here we are on November 1st. This was the last Saturday in October. My wife and I went to see Jon Bon Jovi and Stephen Colbert at NJPAC in New Jersey, in Newark. And the first thing that Jon Bon Jovi said is, what does it mean when you're from New Jersey? And he said, where you are from shapes who you become. And
Oh,
that's
great
perfect,
line.
isn't it? So, and actually in my newsletter this week, anybody who gets my newsletter, you'll see that's the quote that I pulled out from Bon Jovi and Colbert last week, which was great. So, lastly, and most importantly, Mark, where do people find out more information about USA Lacrosse? Where can they find out more information about you? How can we get more people involved in the process?
Oh, thank you for that opportunity. I would encourage people to go to usalacrosse.com. You will find all sorts of resources. on the game. You'll find history, you'll find performance, best practices. It can give you lots of information if you're just starting to learn and want to know more about the game, to you're operating at a high level and you want more high performance understanding. Also, part of that is USA Lacrosse Magazine, which is a digital entertainment component. Great stories, lots and lots of content. There's stuff in front of the member wall, and then there's a lot of stuff that sits behind a member wall. And the membership's only $55 a year for a fan, so there's lots of access. So that's my shameless plug in terms of, learning more, but also it's a great way to be part of lacrosse, support it, support our national teams, but support more kids playing the game. USALacrosse.com and become a member.
Cool. Well, Mike, any parting thoughts before we let Mark go?
No, it's great. Great stuff, great stories, and can't wait to see what lacrosse does going forward.
Cool. Well, once again, Mark Riccio, we want to thank you for taking the time out of your really busy schedule, even though we are both sitting on Long Beach Island here on the first Friday of November. Once again, you've been listening to The Cusp Show. Our guest today was Mark Riccio talking about the past, present, and future of USA Lacrosse as he is the CEO of USA Lacrosse. I'm Joe Favorito. Our co-host today was Mike Schroeder sitting in for Tom Richardson. Thanks for listening. Keep following, keep sending us ideas, and we will see you down the road.